started in November of 96, and I first came to work on Visual J++, which was our Java development tool that I think we had just shipped version 1.1 at the time, and so I came in to be the architect of the next version that was going to sort of more natively build a Java development tool. Well, we worked on it for a couple of years, and we built what I think was actually a great development tool, and we added a bunch of extensions that were specific to Windows because we wanted it to not just be a great Java development tool, but also a great tool for writing Windows apps. And we shipped that, I think, in the summer of 98, and then we had this big lawsuit that immediately followed, and within a couple of months, I think three, the product was enjoined by a judge, and we had to put in big warning dialogues, and it was pretty clear that there were some deeper issues there that were beyond our control as just building the development tool, and we kind of got caught in the middle of a fight behind between the giants there, I think. I mean, it was demoralizing at first, you know, because it really was all about politics and not about technical at all, which is, you know, what the team was good at. I think in a sense, though, it became the worst of times and the best of times because it also gave us clarity about, you know, we need to control our own destiny here about where we're going to go with developers for the next several decades. It became clear that we could not do it by building on top of some other company's core technology. You know, we had to invent our own. And this, in many ways, you know, sort of added to the genesis that became .NET. Right? C++ traditionally is a lower level language. It gives you a lot of rope, and some people say it gives you enough rope that you can go hang yourself. You know, so you can do pretty much anything you want, but it takes more of an effort. And developers were just not productive enough. It was too complicated, too error-prone of a software development environment. And conversely, we had Visual Basic, which was probably too sandboxed, you know, not open enough. It was for a specific kind of app, you know. It was rapid application development for Windows client apps, but we didn't really have an answer on the web server, and the web was starting to happen. And it wasn't clear that there was a smooth path for C++ developers who wanted more productivity. They weren't just going to go right in Basic. You know, there's also sort of the what does your language feel like, and they're used to curly braces and a C-style language, and Visual Basic is a very different lineage. So there was a hole, you know. Wow. The first programming language you learn is clearly the hardest one. Because you gotta not just learn the language, you also gotta understand all the principles behind programming. I mean, what is a variable? What is a method or a function? And, you know, how does this all work? You know, what's data? What's code? Once you do that, learning other languages, I think, is increasingly easy because you come to understand all the things they share, and you can then better focus on what's different. You know, oh, if this is a functional programming language, there's some new things I got to look at there, but pretty much everything else is, you know, I understand how it all works, I understand how to compile a program, how to edit, how to debug, all of that stuff. No one likes change, right? I mean, that's human nature, and developers, they hate it if you try to change something, unless you're trying to change something that really bothers them. And there were a lot of things in that world that they were bothered by, like the complexity of programming in C++, or the lack of sort of easy access to the rest of the world from Visual Basic. And so if you can turn those into positives, if you can fix those problems, then developers can become quite agitated, you know. So, and that's what we tried to do with .NET and with C#. Well, I think Java was... It really changed the game in several fundamental ways. I think the notion of a bytecode that you don't compile the language into native code that you run for a particular CPU, rather you compile it into an abstract representation, and then you implement VMs on different platforms or different CPU architectures, and that gives you a lot of flexibility. And it gives you the ability to control what the program does and to get a deeper understanding of what the program does. And that means you can build sandboxes around the program, which was important for hosting the language in a browser. I think also concepts like garbage collection, type safety, exception handling as native concepts in the language really just remove sort of classes, whole classes of bugs that C++ programmers traditionally would spend a lot of their time on, instead of spending their time on the creative part. So I think programmers uniformly in going from a language like C++ to Java or C#, they always talk about how much more productive they are and how much more they enjoy it, because they get to do more of the creative stuff and less of the housekeeping. C# is a programming language that runs on the .NET common language runtime. It's a language that is in the C and C++ and Java family of languages, so it sort of looks very familiar to a C or C++ or Java programmer. You know, it uses curly braces for denoting blocks, and it has the same operators and precedence levels and whatever as C and C++. So it feels just familiar to those programmers. Well, I think C# is a great language because it makes you very productive. And some of that comes from the language, and some of it comes from the platform. The .NET platform is a very rich platform that supports multiple different application models. You know, you can write client apps, you can write server apps, you can write stuff inside a database, you can write now with Silverlight stuff that's hosted in a web page. So many, many different application models, yet there's a shared library behind all of it, and you get to use the same language for all of it. The language tries to sort of stay out of your way and not force you to do a lot of ceremony and mandatory work. It has simplifying concepts like garbage collection, exception handling, type safety, guaranteed bounce checks on arrays, a lot of safeties that just sort of protect you from yourself or from your own mistakes, right? And so bugs are relatively easy to find, and you get to instead focus on the algorithms, which is what the machine can't do for you. Well, so I was part of the group that initially advocated that we should build a new programming language. We're not going to get there by making small changes to C++, and we can't convince everybody to program in BASIC. We need a new language in the C++ family to sort of move up the abstraction level. And there were some wrangling initially about, well, should we evolve evolutionaries versus revolutionaries? And once the revolutionaries won out, I sort of emerged as the spearheader for the design of the C# language. So I've been, from day one, the chief architect of the language, and has led the design group for the past 10 years or so, and continue to do so today. But I just remember there being many, many meetings where there was a lot of hand-wringing over, should we just evolve COM and ActiveX and DNA, or whatever was the marketing name for that technology at the time, or do we need to just make the leap and build a new platform and really fully embrace all the newness? If you're going to go for something new, it shouldn't be just a little bit different. You should really take this opportunity to clean out the closet and just get the latest, greatest stuff going. Do you know what I mean? Because you're going to live with it for a long time. And we're still living with the decisions we made 10 years ago today, and we're going to live with them for at least another 10, probably another 20. You know, this platform is not just going to go away overnight. So it's important when the opportunity is there to really be aggressive, but then you got to be conservative afterwards. And it's a balance, you know. Creating a new programming language is an interesting mix of art and science, because at one level, a programming language is incredibly logical and built on a mathematical foundation and runs on a machine where everything is ones or zeros. There are no unknowns in between. You know, it's very, very deterministic, and yet the feel of a programming language is a very, very subjective thing. You know, programmers will go, I just like this language because I feel productive in it. Well, that has nothing to do with the mathematics of it or the logic. That's the art part. And you gotta do both. There are many languages that are brilliant mathematically and can be written down using, mathematical formalism, and you can marvel over the way all of this stuff fits together, but they're terrible to program in. And conversely, there are many languages that were built by artists that never really thought about the more logical aspects of the language, and so you get these grab bags of hacks upon hacks upon hacks, and all sorts of odd rules, and no one can really ever understand fully how the language works. So you got to do both. And I think that's what, and we were very conscious of that going into C Sharp, you know. So we definitely made a lot of decisions that were just sort of based on our intuition, but we also made sure to write down a very, very clear and technical specification for the language, which you can buy as a book now, you know, and that literally specifies in excruciating detail how everything works. So, I mean, I'm definitely an engineer. I would not call myself an artist, you know, but maybe I'm an artist when it comes to programming languages, but I'm pretty bad at other kinds of art. The particular process we settled on for C Sharp, and it's actually still ongoing, is we first assembled a design group, a group of people, about six or seven, and then we set up a series of meetings. It would be every Monday, Wednesday, or Friday afternoon. In the beginning, we would meet for 3 hours each afternoon. Now, these days, it's down to two, but we still have that series of meeting going after 10 years. And it was sort of a very collaborative process. I was the benevolent dictator, but I rarely had to exercise my powers. And I think, well, you know, I mean, you know, you got to design a programming language. Well, they've been designed before. You know sort of the components, that they has to have a type system. It has to have overload resolution rules. It has to have statements. It has to have a literal syntax, a lexer, a parser, da 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 da. You know, so you kind of know what you got to build. So you can build a to-do list on a whiteboard and then start knocking them off one by one. We built the compiler and the language specification in parallel, so, and both would influence each other. You know, we'd be writing the specification and in sort of in the process of thinking about a problem abstractly, you discover new corners that you might not find if you're just coding a particular compiler, you know. But likewise, the compiler would sometimes, you know, unearth issues that we hadn't thought about. So there was sort of this feedback loop going in. And in the design group, we had representatives from the compiler implementation team. I would say this process, it differs from others in that our design has been ongoing for 10 years. It's continuous design, if you will. It's not like we would design for a while and then stop and then go implement and then come back a year later, design for a little bit. Rather, it was fluent. You know, we were always designing. We didn't necessarily know when we were going to implement this, or well, you know, it was too late for this version, so it was for the next one. But when you have a continuous process like that, you can capture good ideas when they happen, as opposed to those good ideas that so happened to be there when you were designing. And good ideas never arrive on schedule, right? They never. I mean, they arrive one day in the shower. I was, you know, thinking of this, and poof, and. And then the great thing is you can go in, you have an ongoing process, so if you're not meeting today, you're meeting tomorrow. You can walk into a room with people that you've met with and have built an incredible rapport with. So you don't have to first spend 45 minutes setting the stage on this thing and explaining to everybody what are all the surrounding concepts before you get to the problem in the last 5 minutes of the meeting, and then the meeting's over. Do you know what I mean? You walk in, and within 2 minutes, you're having a deep technical discussion about something because everybody has the same context. So that's proven to be very valuable, which is why we've held on to this process too. We also have taken copious notes. We literally have meeting notes going back 10 years. In the last 6 months, we finally decided to implement a feature that we designed about 9 years ago, and we could dig out the old notes and go, oh, look at this. Yeah, we actually already thought of that back then. And so language, I mean, it just proves that language design moves slowly. You know, it's not like a hit business, you know, in that sense. Recently, in the work we did on C Sharp 3.0, we implemented a feature called Language Integrated Query, and that was entirely new ground. No one has really done the kind of stuff that we did in the language. No one's really done that before, at least not to the extent that we did it. And so we were literally groping around in the dark. And there were many cases where we would just keep going over and over and over. And then all of a sudden it would just boom. You know, you'd get this simplifying idea, or you'd realize that you were just barking up the wrong tree. And really that simple thing you had thought about originally, that was really all you could meaningfully do. I mean, it's the best thing when you're sitting in a design meeting and you can just feel how this is just so right, you know, and everybody knows that we all know it's just on the whiteboard right now. It doesn't exist anywhere other than in our heads, but we all know that this is gonna change programmers' lives. It may take 2-3 years before they hold it in their hands, but you know that it happened right here, you know. and you just sort of know that when you put it in the box, everybody's going to love it. You know, you can't do this if you're not excited about it. I've always believed that you got to be passionate about what you do, because that's the only way you can be great about it. You can't be great at something if you're not passionate about it, if you don't really care about it, you know. It's interesting because most of the apps you don't actually see because they're not desktop apps. .NET has seen tremendous success in the enterprise space, and we have, I mean, literally, you pick any Fortune 1000 company, and they will use some of our stuff somewhere. Lots and lots of websites, you know, are run on our infrastructure, and you can sort of see if you look, just whenever you see the file extension ASPX, you know, that means it's written with ASP.NET, and so that typically means either C# or VB, and so it's everywhere. I mean, you go anywhere, you know, and you run into it. There are also some cool client apps, like one that I find fun, you know, and then just because my kids are playing with this, is this app called Worldwide Telescope from Microsoft Research, which is this whole new interactive experience on top of an image library provided by NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope that allows you to just fluidly fly around in the universe and zoom in on planets and stars, you know, to like amazing detail. You zoom in on Earth from outer space, and you can go all the way down to your house in a fluid motion. You know, and that's written in C#, and that's kind of fun to know. You know, so we've always competed with Java in this space. I think there are other dynamic programming languages out there, you know, that I might mention: Python, Ruby on Rails, or whatever. You know, there's a whole plethora of other languages. You know, but our biggest is definitely Java. Java is now mostly built in the open source universe, and so they have a completely different business model from ours. They run on more platforms than we do. It's a different developer experience, well, actually, the developer experience is not, but the ecosystem is very different, you know. I think a lot of customers in our world value the fact that we test the whole stack, top to bottom, you know, like OS, database servers, development tools, runtimes, the whole thing comes from one place. And if there's something wrong with it, you know whose fault it is. Open source is a little different in that it's really nobody's fault. It's your fault because you're a part of the process. And that works well for some customers and less well for others. So I think those are sort of the biggest differences between the two. Really, it's not so much at a technical, well, I mean, there's a myriad of differences technically, but really the deepest difference is the underlying philosophical difference, I think. We launched C# at the Professional Developers Conference in 2000, which was, I think, in Orlando, and it was in the summer, and it was very hot. That's one thing I do remember. But that was sort of the big coming out party for .NET and C#, and it was a lot of fun, because remarkably, not a lot of information had leaked about it, and whatever had leaked sounded so far-fetched that no one believed it. And there we were, actually, boom, you know, this whole completely game-changing thing, you know, compared to what our developers were using currently. And there was, of course, a lot of skepticism and a lot of excitement, and so it was just a lot of fun being there and popping that one on a big audience and engaging their reaction.
What was the reaction?
Oh, it was, like I said, excitement, disbelief. you know, or are you nuts? You know, are you going to do that? Or you know, I don't believe it for a minute. You know, but the thing was, we also gave developers bits to work with. So people walked out of there with stuff they could put on their machine and actually see that it was real. And I think that silenced, obviously, a lot of the skeptics. And to be fair, we had been guilty of lots of marketecture before that, where you walked away with nothing other than slide decks, you know. But this one was different. And I think that pleased a lot of our customers. And but at the time, you know, people were very skeptical about anything we did in the developer space. It's not every day you get to build a new programming language and have Microsoft put their marketing machine behind it, and you kind of wonder what's going to happen, you know. This could be a gigantic failure. I thought, personally, I had seen certainly in-house that that developers were very happy using the language. And so we weren't just, you know, throwing it out there without any code being written in it. We had written pretty much the whole framework in C# and large parts of Visual Studio in C# as well. So by the time it reached customer hands, it was actually already pretty solid. And all the indicators were, I'd say, in the green, you know, and so it panned out pretty well. But you never know for sure, obviously.
How was your heart?
Oh, it was exciting times, definitely. I think between 2005, 2008, I think our technology has now gotten much more mature. And it's not so much about, you know, the radical new as it is about finding better ways of being more efficient about your development and about all of the tedious tasks in development. So one of the things we focus a lot on is this thing we call code-focused development. And it boils down to the ability to do code refactorings or have the development environment rewrite your code for you with a deep understanding of what the code does. Because a lot of edits, let's say I want to go rename a variable somewhere in my program, right? Let's say it's called X. But let's say in other places in my program, I also have a variable called X. Well, now I could decide I want to call X, Y, and I could just globally search and replace in all my files, and now all my X's are called Y's, but I might have broken something over there, you know. So I want to sort of be able to say I want to rename this X to Y, but not that other X, and have the system understand, you know, which X are we talking about, right? And that requires a deeper semantic understanding in the development environment. That's something that really has been happening a lot in development tools. I think also a thing that's exciting right now for us is Silverlight, and you know, the fact that we now have a browser embeddable runtime to run .NET applications behind web pages, and with a great video experience, and I think we'll see, you know, a lot more client development go that route, because it's a very, very natural way to evolve your apps. I've seen glimpses of what's new, and I sort of have an idea of some of the ingredients that would be in the next language. I'm not sure I have seen the next language. I'm sort of a great believer in trying to evolve what you have and add, you know, you look at new ideas come out, and every new language has 10% new and 90% the same as everybody else, because, you know, you can't make everything new. And so it's interesting to understand, you know, when you see other new languages, what is it that's new here, and how does that help developers, and is there a way we could fit that into our language and make it do more? So we've added a lot of functional programming constructs to C#, particularly in version 3. That sort of came from looking at functional programming in academia and other functional programming languages, and it's remarkable how if you can couple it to existing apps, and then it's all gravy. There's no, you know, immediate or no big cost to buying in, because you can just start picking up these new features in your existing apps. You don't have to first rewrite them in another language. And this process of rewriting is increasingly becoming costly. You know, I mean, like, users demand more and more, systems are more and more complex, frameworks do more and more. So every rewrite takes longer, costs more, you know, more resources. So there are fewer and fewer of them, and really the takeaway is that it's all about reuse. And if you can reuse and extend existing systems with new capabilities, then you really stand a much better chance of winning. So that's what we're trying to do. Well, the first thing we launched was basically a beta or a preview of the product. So in 2000, this was not final bits, and we saw a lot of, you know, early adopters at that point, people experimenting with it, trying to write stuff. We didn't actually ship until 2002. I do remember that there was enough adoption that we actually had almost a flood of customer requests asking, could they please deploy these things, even though we haven't shipped the product yet, because it was working so well for them. And we did have some early go-live licenses that allowed them to actually go live with their websites before we had even shipped the final version of the product. So the final version came out in 2002, and it's been a pretty solid ramp up ever since, and we still see C# adoption increasing. In fact, I just recently saw some numbers from O'Reilly, which is a book publisher, and C# is now the number one computer language in programming book sales, which was wonderful to see, you know. And that's book sales are one of these, you know, early indicators of adoption or still ongoing adoption because people are still buying books to learn, you know, how to program in this language. So, but we definitely have way over a million developers now day-to-day using C#. So,
wow.
So it's been pretty big, yeah.
So have you overtaken Java then?
Well, it depends on how you measure. I think by if you measure new projects, I see numbers that say we have. I see numbers that say we haven't. So I'm not exactly sure. I would say we're about even with Java is my sense of it, yeah.
And that's pretty good.
Oh, if you told me 7 years ago that we'd be even with Java today, I thought there's no way this is gonna happen. So I'm very happy with that. Yeah, but of course that doesn't mean we're done. But it's a nice milestone. I'm sort of a believer in at least having. It'd be nice if your programming language could be a one-stop shop for whatever app you're gonna build today. Is it a client app or a web app or a browser app or whatever, and what are you going to talk to? Are you going to talk to native APIs or managed APIs, and are you going to talk to other programming languages? Do you need functional programming constructs? Do you need to talk to dynamic languages? I mean, there are all these different things, and you could sort of put yourself into a silo and say, we are a functional programming language for web development only, right? Well, so that means if I got to go write one of these other ones, I got to learn a whole new platform and a whole new language. That doesn't seem very leveraged, right? So by one-stop shopping, I mean leverage. You know, it's great if you can leverage your existing skills and only have to learn the absolute minimal delta to get you to this other thing, right? And that's what we try to do a lot of. You know, I identify what is it that a lot of our or some large group of our developers want to do that they can't yet do, and how could we make that easier by adding stuff to the language? But you always got to be cautious about adding, because it could very quickly become just you know, a haphazard collection of random features, you know. So you got to be judicious, but on the other hand, you can't just stop, or you can't just put yourself in a silo, because then you're just not applicable enough. We all keep up to date with what's going on in the industry, be it on our platform or on other platforms. There are lots of programming languages conferences or conferences that have a high content of programming languages. It's a small industry. Everybody knows everybody. I mean, I know a lot of the other programming language creators out there and run into them at events or conferences. And so everybody sort of knows what everybody else is up to. There are lots of, you know, science papers you can read or academic papers and so forth. But yeah, a big part of the job is just keeping up to date with what's happening. Do we steal from each other? Absolutely. Yeah, everybody steals from everybody in this industry. It's well known that in the science of programming languages, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, it would be foolhardy to take someone who has never seen a programming language and ask them to create one, because there's so much we've learned before. Programming languages are as old as computers, you know. So the first programming languages were created 50 years ago, and the ones we use today don't look all that different. And so there's so much to learn. You simply cannot afford to ignore it. So you must steal, or else you will fail, you know. I think we're actually right now at a particularly sort of tricky point, because I don't know if you've noticed, but everybody is starting to get multiple CPUs in their machines now, you know, dual cores, quad cores, and so forth. And that's because we've run up against some fundamental limits now in transistor speed. We can't crank up the clock rate anymore, because things start to melt down if we crank it up anymore. So things are not getting faster anymore. However, we can still fit more CPUs on circuits, so now we get more of them. And now the challenge for us as programming language designers is to figure out, how do you use multiple CPUs in a program when everybody was taught to program single-threaded And that's a big challenge. It's the concurrency challenge, and it's not an easy one. It's probably one of the biggest challenges we've seen for software in the last several decades. But that's what makes the job interesting too. You know, there's you never stand still.
So it was one of your goals now to crack that challenge, to figure out how that's going to work.
Long term, yes, it's our goal to crack the challenge. But I can't promise you that we'll crack it in 6 months, or it's going to be an iterative process, you know, and we're going to get there in steps. But yeah, we have to remain relevant. Yeah.
Are you going to get there ahead of everybody else, do you think?
Hopefully. The language and the development environment sort of have this symbiotic relationship. You know, in a sense, they're very different. And you can use the language without the development environment. And the development environment can do a bunch of other things that are not related to the programming language. But there's sort of a symbiosis that you strive for, where you want the whole to be greater than the sum of the parts, right? And that means that there are certain things you have to think about when you design the language. Like, this may make for a wonderful language feature, you think, but it turns out to be impractical in the IDE. It's hard to tool this particular language feature. One example here would be when we did the work with Link and added query comprehensions to the language, and it gets a little technical here, but you know the way we sort of have a from, where, select in our queries, you know, makes it easier to tool because, as opposed to if you start comparing to SQL, where the select clause goes first, and now you can't do statement completion because when you type select, you don't know where from where things are coming. But if you put the from clause first, then users first get to say where they're selecting from, and then we can be intelligent about helping them complete the rest. And it's in a sense, it's like that's like a little technical hole, right? But if you do it the right way, then the developer experience becomes better. And developers tend to not think about IDEs and languages as being particularly separate. You know, they're just necessary evils that you must master in order to write your program. But we have to think about how the interplay between the two. And I think we take that very seriously in the design group. We don't just willy-nilly design language features without first considering how toolable they are. And so in that sense, I think the two influence each other a lot. I think this whole industry was built on constant innovation. And, you know, the minute we stop innovating, then we're done, right? I mean, then we can just go home. You know, it's like it's what fuels everything we do is this relentless push to make it better, more functional, you know, build new form factors, merge different technologies. So I think it's... Yeah, it's tough, you know. It can be hard to master, and that we gotta build better tools. But we just gotta push on. We can't stop. The minute we stop, we become irrelevant. So I'm sort of a big believer in you just gotta push forward. I think we have many areas that we wanna push into. You know, concurrency was one I talked about. We definitely wanna make programmers more productive, keep raising the abstraction level, and that means, you know, look at more declarative ways of programming where you say more of the what of your program, but less of the how. Today, there's too much how. You know, programs are, in a sense, you over-specify the solution when you write your programs. You're groveling around in a lot of lower details about how you want this algorithm executed. If we could move to a higher level, you know, and that is, in a sense, what programming languages have done for their entire lifespan. I think there's some interesting stuff happening between static and dynamic programming languages and more interactive programming experiences that we're looking at. So programming languages go back at least 50 years. You know, you can look all the way back to the 50s where some of the ancient languages like Fortran and COBOL were created. You can look at sort of a lineage into languages like C, and then there was a language called Pascal that I personally was involved with before I came to Microsoft at a company called Borland, where I created a product called Turbo Pascal. Microsoft itself was founded on the programming language called BASIC. The first product, literally, that the company created was Microsoft BASIC more than 30 years ago. And, you know, And programming languages have always held, I feel, a special place at Microsoft, perhaps because it was our first product, but also because it's like so integral to the whole, you know, sort of process of creating software. It all starts in a programming language, you know, the creative process, I think, or at least the implementation process. So, and that continues to be true for most applications today. So programming languages they're very special. At least they're special to me, yeah. My first encounter with programming was at my high school. I was born and grew up in Denmark, and our high school was one of the first high schools to offer access to a computer to the students. So this is back in the mid-70s or late 70s. They had an HP 2100, I think it was called. It had like 32K of ferrite core memory. You could open it up and literally see the hand-woven little ferrite cores that made up the memory. And to get it to run, you had to like type in a bootloader on some octal panel in front, and then that would load a paper tape bootloader that would then load the operating system off of some gigantic hard drive with 1 megabyte of storage on it. So it was a lot of fun. It was a very tactile kind of computing, if you will. I went from there to build my own kit computer, which was a Z80-based computer where you had to like solder it all together yourself, and of course it didn't work, and then you have to figure out why it didn't work, and so that taught you a lot about the hardware, and then once you did get it to work, then it couldn't do anything at all, and so now you had to figure out how to make it to do things, you know. So it was very, very elementary, you know, and I was lucky enough to be there that early so that you really sort of have a very deep understanding of all the different layers that make up a computer system today, and there are many, but it was fun. Yeah.
How did you get that machine that couldn't do anything to do something?
a lot of hard work. You know, I think it's you just sort of, I mean, this is, there weren't really any books that explained you. I mean, there was the CPU manufacturer's manual, and so you had to, first of all, you had to understand hex, so you had to figure out binary numbers and hex numbers, and then you sort of understood how CPU instructions worked, and then you could try to type in some numbers and say, now run there, and then bloop, it would do stuff, and look, hey, it did what I told it to do, you know, which might have been blink this light or whatever, you know. But gradually then you got it to do more and more, right? And really that is like the primitive bits that everything comes from in programming. It's just, you're just doing more and more advanced things, but it all breaks down to just really, really simple things done very fast. I'm a control freak, and programming is all about exercising absolute control over this little world that does precisely what you want it to do, and of course sometimes it doesn't, but then it is your fault. It is not the world, you know, the world is just always does what you tell it to do, do you know what I mean? And it's up to you to tell it to do the right things, right? So in that sense, it's a very controllable device, you know, and that. But it's amazing what it can do. It's like more complicated than any chess game you could imagine, right? But just sort of taming and mastering that beast, you know, is fun. Originally was sort of a very lone endeavor, and it to many people still is, you know. Yeah, I just had this little kit computer, and I started, you know, building more and more software. I ended up building a Pascal compiler by myself. Eventually, I had to learn to be a team player. You know, a team of one doesn't scale all that well, you know, and as we talked about earlier, you know, like requirements are forever going up. So there's very little you can do as a single individual today. You just have to understand how to work with a team, and today I'd say I'm a pretty good team player, you know. Yeah.
Was it hard for you to become a team player?
Yes, it was. It's when, hey, like I said, when you're a control freak, it's hard to be a team player. Or it's hard to be a good team player.